Today on the 21st show, a century ago, the activist Marcus Garvey was working to unite black people around the world, creating a nationalist movement that would oppose colonialism in Africa and invite people of African descent to self-rule in their homeland.
We of the Universal Negro Movement Association are raising the cry of Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad.
One of the places Garvey's ideas found significant purchase was in the American Midwest. And that's the subject of a new book by University of Illinois professor Eric McDuffie. It's called The Second Battle for Africa. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. In the early part of the last century, Marcus Garvey had a dream. Through his organization, known in the language of the time as the Universal Negro Improvement Association, Garvey wanted all the world's people of African descent to unite Africans in Africa, freeing the continent from colonial rule and embarking on a project of self-determination at a continental scale.
Citizens of Africa, I greet you in the name of the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League of the World. You may ask, what organization is that? It is for me to inform you that the Universal Negro Improvement Association is an organization that seeks to unite into one solid body the 400 million Negroes of the world. We link up the 15 million Negroes of the United States of America with the 20 million Negroes of the West Indies, the 40 million Negroes of South and Central America, with the 280 million Negroes of Africa, for the purpose of bettering our industrial, commercial, educational, social, and political conditions.
Garvey's organization, the UNIA, was the largest of its era, and one of the places it found significant uptake was in the American Midwest. As the historian Eric S. McDuffie puts it in a book published earlier this year, that's in part because the American Midwest was simultaneously one of the world's most prosperous and oppressive places for African Americans. McDuffie is an associate professor in history and African American studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and this fall he's becoming director of the Center for African Studies on campus. His book is called The Second Battle for Africa: Garveyism, the U.S. Heartland, and Global Black Freedom. Earlier this year, the Midwestern History Association awarded McDuffie the John Jerde Prize for the best book in Midwestern history, published last year. We first aired my conversation with McDuffie back in May, so no phone calls today, but let us know what you thought. Talk at 21stshow.org. Eric McDuffie joins me now in studio. Welcome to the 21st Show. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great being back.
All right. Who was Marcus Garvey?
Oh, great question. And that clip, I think, in some ways captured his brilliance. So he was born in Jamaica in 1887, passed away in London in 1940. Arguably, he stands as the most important black person of the 20th century. You heard in his speech how he's calling for the self-determination of African people globally. His call for 400 million Africans. It's very, very powerful. And Garvey was critical to inspiring the U.S. Civil Rights Black Power Movement, was critical to inspiring the independence movements in the Caribbean as well as Africa.
Talk about his big idea of this idea of Africa for Africans.
Africa for the Africans. Yeah, certainly. Well, so Garvey was not the first person to make that claim, that statement. He drew from a long history of black nationalism, a movement, a consciousness in which African descended peoples in the Americas came to believe that they were a nation within a nation entitled to self-determination. Black nationalism was really the first collective response of African people after our arrival and enslavement to this new horror that we had encountered. And Garvey was building off a long tradition of black nationalist thinkers and movements. But certainly during the early 20th century, right after the end of the First World War, which then was the most violent, destructive conflict humanity had ever seen in this country, the war was followed by so-called race riots, lynchings across Africa, anti-colonial revolts were violently put down by Europeans. So this was a moment, right? This was a very violent but also very exciting moment to organize black people. And Garvey, as well as Amy Ashwood Garvey, who was a black nationalist, Pan-Africanist in her own right, became who was his first wife. They co-founded the UNIA in 1914 in Kingston, Jamaica. And as you pointed out, the UNIA became actually the largest black movement in history. They claimed more than 6 million members in the U.S., Central America, the Caribbean, Europe, West Africa, East Africa, South Africa, Australia, South America.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to venture to say, and maybe I'm revealing my own ignorance here, but the UNIA is not a household name the way other, you know, rights organizations have been. It isn't today, you know, at least among the mass public. What was it? Tell us more about what it was, what its aims were, how it developed.
Sure. Well, to be clear, the UNIA still very much exists, although there are at least three splinter groups, but it's still quite active. And Garveyism is still very much alive in terms of the red, black, and green flag. When we spoke a couple years ago about George Floyd and Black Lives Matter, all those red, black, and green flags that you saw, that came from Garvey. Garvey invented that flag. The UNIA, again, was the largest black movement in history. It understood itself as a provisional government for Africa. As well as an organization to advance the upliftment of black people. Garvey called for human rights. I mean, he actually used that term, human rights, in the 1920s. He called for an independent Africa. He called for the self-defense of black people. And he called for black people knowing themselves in terms of our history, our culture, being proud of who we are.
Why does the UNIA find such interest or purchase, or however you want to phrase it, among people in the Midwest of America?
Sure, it's a great question. So, you know, as we said already, Garveyism electrified the black world, but especially here in the Midwest. So Chicago, Cleveland, Detroit, Omaha, Gary, Lansing, as well as rural parts of the Midwest, central Michigan, southwest Ohio. And what I argue in the book is what I call the dialectic of opportunity and oppression, that going back to the end of the 18th century, black people in this country saw this part of the world as a place where they can could enjoy more freedom than anywhere else. Certainly slavery existed here, various forms of racial discrimination existed here, but beginning in the early 19th century, formerly enslaved black people came here in search of freedom. But at the same time, that this region was the site of the most advanced industrial capitalist production on the planet, right? So auto, steel, rubber, so Chicago, the stockyards, Detroit, the automobile plants, you know, steel in Youngstown, Cleveland, Chicago, beyond. So folks came here to find a better life. At the very same time, as I pointed out already, this region has a very long, violent history against black people. This region passed what were called black laws in the early part of the 19th century, banning black people from coming here, banning black men from serving on juries, banning black children from going to public schools. They really anticipated the black codes that would follow the end of the Civil War, as well as, again, I could go on and on and on. And then as we move into the 20th century, as I'm sure you know, Indiana, Chicago, Detroit were sites or hotbeds of the Ku Klux Klan, Nazism, going into the post-World War II period. Again, the attacks against black people in places like Chicago, Detroit. So this region created a kind of cauldron where, again, black folks both found unprecedented opportunities and at the same time found just virulent racial oppression, which helped to radicalize black people here. And then again, so everything that was going on laid the foundations for the reception of Garveyism. So, for example, as we know, yesterday, right, was the 100th anniversary, or rather the 100th centenary of Malcolm X's birth. Of course, Brother Malcolm was born in Omaha, Nebraska. He was a Midwesterner, came up in Lansing, Michigan, that part of the state then and now was a real hotbed of right-wing racist movements and people. And again, so this region, it was a cauldron for inspiring black people. And again, Chicago, Cleveland, Detroit, hotbeds not only of the UNIA, but various formations that it spawned. So the Nation of Islam, More Science, I can go on, the Peace Movement of Ethiopia. I could go on and on.
Yeah, well, let's dive into one of the aspects you mentioned there. It was a place, and I'm reading from the book now, blacks in the U.S. heartland enjoyed political rights they could find nowhere else. Maybe talk about what that was like, what form that took, because I think that might surprise people who are less familiar with this era in history.
Yeah, so, you know, going to now the early 20th century, Great Migration, Chicago was the largest destination of black people from the Jim Crow South, moving to the south side of Chicago due to segregation, housing covenants, racist realtors, you know, compressing black people into a very, very small space. But that place was more than just, a so-called, quote-unquote, ghetto. It was a dynamic community of learning, institution building. I emphasize the importance of the Midwest, that black
people. Black metropolis, right?
Yeah, is what it becomes. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. How Chicago and indeed the South Side, Bronzeville, a real site of black modernity, institution building, militancy. And so, again, in these densely populated communities, you have, and then the fact that black people could vote in the North, right? So that created the opportunity for African-American electoral politics. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Let me remind listeners, we're talking with Eric McDuffie, professor at the University of Illinois and author of the book, The Second Battle for Africa, which came out earlier this year. It seeks to understand the historic role of the Midwest and America and its role in the global African freedom struggle. So what is, we've talked about who Marcus Garvey was, we've talked about the UNIA, what is Garveyism?
Sure. So again, Garveyism, a great question. So Garveyism is an ideology, a black nationalist ideology, a Pan-Africanist ideology. The Pan-Africanism refers to a movement of consciousness in which black people understand themselves as linked to global Africa, that our destinies are inextricably connected. And it's important to understand that when we say Garvey, Garveyism, the UNIA, Garvey formations, that those terms, while they are similar, they're not quite synonymous, right? That so there are people who interpret it and from the right, from the left, Marxists, cultural nationalists, Rastafarian, Black Jews, Muslims, who embraced Garvey and Garveyism. If we can, Brother Brian, what I would like to really stress, right, is the importance of women, right? Mm. So Louise Little, who is, really one of my favorite subjects in my book. She's best known as the mother of Malcolm X, born in Grenada. In fact, a fascinating story. I'll keep it short. Her grandparents were apparently born in Nigeria, and apparently they were Yoruba, the world's largest African ethnic group. Apparently they were also Muslims. They came to Grenada by the 1820s, 1830s or so, 1840s, and they instilled in Louise and the family the ethos or the ethics of self-reliance and pride. And trigger warning to the audience, of course, as pointed out in the autobiography of Malcolm X, Louise Little was the product of rape, right? She was her mother, who was only 11 at the time, was sexually assaulted by a white man. From that crime came Louise Little, or Langdon as the family's name was and is in Grenada. But still, she was very fair complected, but she identified herself as Black, deeply proud of being Black. She spoke English, she spoke patois, spoke French. She went to Canada, where in 1917, she joined the UNIA. She married her husband, Earl Little, an African-American man from Georgia. Then the Littles moved to Philadelphia, and then they go out to Omaha, apparently because Garvey asked them to go to Omaha to build a UNIA local or division, in part because Omaha was the site of a post-World War I riot, race riot, sparked by rumors that a Black man had raped some white woman. And in the ensuing violence, yes, Black folks were killed, but also Black folks shot back, as they did elsewhere. And Garvey was really intrigued by Black folks in Omaha, Nebraska, in the Midwest, right?
Sure.
Fighting back. And he said Omaha was going to be our Waterloo, right?
Because he's in New York.
Yeah, exactly. In Harlem. And so he sent the Littles to Omaha. And the long and short is the autobiography of Malcolm X, it talks about Louise being born in Grenada, being a product of rape, but frames Earl Little as the Garveyite and Louise as a good wife and faithful wife and good mom. In reality, Louise, as a family has told me, she was the genius in the household. And of course, she was a hardcore Garveyite. She was an officer in the UNIA local in Omaha, Milwaukee, elsewhere. And she was brilliant. She really helped to cultivate the Black radical internationalism, the Black nationalism, the Black pride, the self-learning in her most famous child, Malcolm X.
Yeah, you've got a great quote about that right at the beginning of the book. We are talking with Eric McDuffie, a professor at the University of Illinois. His new book is The Second Battle for Africa, Garveyism, the U.S. Heartland, and Global Black Freedom. It seeks to understand the historic role of the Midwest in America and its role in the global African freedom struggle. Mm-hmm. We're going to continue this conversation after a break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us.
Support for The 21st Show comes from listeners like you and the Des Moines Arts Center, located in Iowa's capital city, featuring works by regional, national, and international artists of the 20th and 21st centuries. Details are at DesMoinesArtsCenter.org.
It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Marcus Garvey, as we've been discussing, was a Black nationalist. And as you can hear in one of the two known audio recordings of his voice from 1921, he situated his campaign among other nationalist movements of the day.
As you are aware, the world in which we live today is divided into separate race groups and distinct nationalities. Each race and each nationality is endeavoring to work out its own destiny to the exclusion of other races and other nationalities. We hear the cry of England for the Englishman, of France for the Frenchman, of Germany for the German, of Ireland for the Irish, of Palestine for the Jew, of Japan for the Japanese, of China for the Chinese. We of the Universal Negro Movement Association are raising the cry of Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad. There are 400 million Africans in the world who have Negro blood coursing through their veins. And we believe that the time has come to unite these 400 million people for the one common purpose of bettering their condition.
We're talking about Garvey, his movement, the special appeal it held for African Americans in the Midwest, and how that connects to the global struggle for Black freedom. My guest is University of Illinois History and African American Studies Professor Eric McDuffie. His latest book is The Second Battle for Africa, Garveyism, the U.S. Heartland, and Global Black Freedom. All right, before the break, we're talking about Louise Little, arguably best known in history as the mother of Malcolm X. You tell the story of, which is, you know, seminal to the Malcolm X, you know, mythology or his origin story of the night that the riders or whatever you want to say came to terrorize her family in Omaha.
Absolutely. Great question. So As many of your listeners probably know, if they've read the autobiography of Malcolm X, the autobiography of Malcolm X, the first chapter is titled Nightmare. And it begins with Louise Little standing off or standing up to a Klansman who had ridden to her house in Omaha, Nebraska, demanding the whereabouts of her husband, Earl Little. Earl was not at home. He apparently was preaching in Milwaukee. He was a lay Baptist preacher, and as well as, of course, a Garveyite preacher. She informed the Klan that, again, that her husband wasn't there. And what she did, apparently, is that she turned her body to expose her pregnant abdomen, torso, to the Klansmen so they knew that she was pregnant. She told them that she had a few young children at home and that she was home alone. And just by being so confident and steadfast, the Klansmen rode off. They did break windows, but they thankfully they didn't shoot or kill anybody. The way the autobiography of Malcolm X frames the story is that so even and I'm sorry, and that pregnant that child is Brother Malcolm, right? So even in utero, right? Right before he's even right. born, right? He's like, you know, fighting, he's facing racism. But in some ways, the autobiography doesn't really flesh this out. Again, in terms of, I mean, so yes, it was a very brave act. And the autobiography of Malcolm X makes it clear that Louise was very brave in standing up to the Klan, but again, the autobiography doesn't focus on her brilliance and the importance of black women to building and leading the UNIA, the Nation of Islam, other black movements in the Garveyite tradition. What the autobiography does do is it focuses on, and this is quite sad, and of course I discuss this in my book, that during the 30s, after Louise, after Earl was killed under mysterious circumstances, the autobiography says that he was lynched. Again, he died violently, to be sure. So in the 30s, during the heart of the Great Depression, Louise and her now 8 children are living in central Michigan during the height of the Great Depression, facing crazy racism. And, you know, after 8 long years of trying to take care of her family, she suffered a mental breakdown. And what I argue is that we should, and then the state of Michigan institutionalized her in a mental health hospital in Kalamazoo, Michigan for 25 years. And what I argue in my book is that we should really think about her institutionalization in that mental health hospital as a form of incarceration, and indeed that think of her as a political prisoner, given her Garveyite politics, given the way in which the state framed the fact that she'd had a child out of wedlock and she was Afro-Caribbean, and again, all the kind of heteronormative, racist, sexist tropes that the state then and now uses against black people, people of color, women of color in particular. But again, the autobiography of Malcolm X, in terms of her story, ends in 1963. But in reality, she lived another almost 30 years, and she reconnected with family. She lived her final years in Michigan. She was never again a public figure per se, but she was again her children, her grandchildren, great grandchildren. She became endeared or indeed loved by her family. And what's exciting is today there are a number of scholars, not just me, but a number of scholars who are writing about Louise Little, holding conferences about her. So as I always say, you can't talk about Brother Malcolm without talking about his mother, Louise Little.
If we can shift a little bit here, one of the interesting points that you bring up in this book is that sometimes Garveyism is in some ways like a right movement, right? Like when you think of national, or maybe I'm overstating that and you can complicate that, mm-hmm. please do. Mm-hmm. But like sometimes the people in this movement did make common cause with like some of the white supremacist forces.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And maybe you can talk about that.
Yeah. So it's important to keep in mind that Garveyism, like in some ways, so many ideology, it spans the ideological spectrum, right? So there are folks who consider themselves third world Marxists, you know, hardcore communists, anti-imperialists, who consider themselves Marxists. I'm sorry, Garveyites. And then you have right-wing folks who, as you pointed out, collaborated with white supremacists because they accepted biological understandings of race, advocated racial separatism. I think that's the beauty, that's the complexity, those are the paradoxes of Garveyism. And Garvey himself kind of swung from left to right during the course of his life. So during his most famous years, that's when he was most radical on the kind of left side of what was called the New Negro Movement. By the end of his life, he had become pretty right-wing, had lost many of his followers, but still the work and his legacy was already there.
Why do you think the Midwest has been overlooked in this area of, in this entire like field of scholarship?
It's a great question. Yeah. So what my book tries to do, not tries, what it does, is one, it challenges the erasure of the Midwest in studies of the African diaspora in relation to this country and beyond. So often when we talk about the African diaspora, the global dispersion of African people globally, when we talk about that in relation to the U.S., it's Harlem, it's Charleston, New Orleans, the Chesapeake, again, very important places, but the Midwest falls out. And when so often when scholars of African-American history, I'm sorry, of African-American Midwestern life and history talk about this region, it's done so often within the confines of the U.S. So in doing that, we miss the way in which global forces have always been critical to shaping this region that we now call the Midwest. And I think it's important to say now because, of course, this term Midwest is only a couple hundred years old of that. We, of course, are on conquered indigenous land, certainly in indigenous folks then and still now didn't really think of this as quote unquote the Midwest. I mean, that's all kind of imperial stuff, right? and then going back to diaspora. So what I'm again trying to emphasize is that this region, this part of the world that we now call the Midwest, was critical to shaping 20th century Black history, Black life through Garveyism.
You traveled extensively in researching this book. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that, right? It was in America. I mean, and in part, your family makes a cameo in this story.
Absolutely.
But, you know, the Caribbean, also Africa.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I started researching this book back in 2009, but in some ways this book is really, as I know, is deeply personal, right? That I was born in Detroit, raised in suburban Cleveland. My grandmother was born and raised in Toronto. Her mother was born in St. Kitts in the Caribbean. I didn't know my great-grandmother very well, but I knew that she was from the Caribbean. And as a child, as a young person, my parents purchased a second home in Puerto Rico. So I spent a lot of time as a kid in Puerto Rico. So again, I understood that I was part of a much larger world. My great-grandfather was a hardcore Garveyite. He was a prominent minister in Detroit. He introduced Mr. Garvey on one visit in 1923. But yeah, so in terms of my research, yeah, I conducted research in 8 countries. Let me see, Grenada, Ghana, Liberia, Jamaica, Trinidad and Tobago, South Africa, Ghana, Canada, the U.S., and the U.K. I think that covers all. So 3 continents. I interviewed more than 100 plus people, at least visited scores and scores of archives on 3 continents. It was a lot of work. It was a lot of traveling, but I learned a lot.
All right. Let me reintroduce our conversation. We're talking with University of Illinois Professor Eric McDuffie about his book, The Second Battle for Africa, Garveyism, the U.S. Heartland, and Global Black Freedom. We first recorded this conversation in May, so no phone calls today, but we did take calls when it first aired. And we have Paul calling in from Urbana. Paul, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. The UNIA was, it's a shame that it fell apart after Garvey was gone, but I guess that's the way it went. It was really important in the cultural life of African Americans. It was the home for jazz, apparently. There's a book by an Englishman that I'm desperately trying to remember what it was that sort of chronicled that. But I also wanted to mention, and this historical view is really important, but I wanted to bring up Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, because their legacy would have been really important. It was also snuffed out. They exist as martyrs, but they were killed by the Red Squad in Chicago. And when you're thinking about overall the role of African Americans in the Midwest, I think they should get a mention. I do appreciate the historical work that you've done. And
All right, Paul, thank you so much. Let's ask Professor McDuffie to respond to some of that.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great question. Well, again, to be clear, and what my book does argue against, it argues against the denouement narrative of Garveyism that frames, that says that after Garvey was deported in 1927 for allegedly for mail fraud, of course, the U.S. government, J. Edgar Hoover, took down Garvey, and that was J. Edgar Hoover's first big takedown, which has, I think, very important implications for understanding our moment right now. Mm. And then Garvey, of course, died in 1940. Yes, it's true, the UNIA was never the same after the late 20s, but it continued to exist, and it continued to do some really exciting work. But also, what I argue is that Garveyism enjoyed new life in multiple formations, political, cultural, religious organizations. I've already said the Nation of Islam, Moorish Science, of course, in Jamaica, and then beyond, the Rastafari. But I think it's that we can see the legacies of Garveyism perhaps most pronounced in the Midwest. So going back to your speaker, I couldn't agree more in terms of Mark Clark, Fred Hampton, the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. The Black Panthers were very much inspired by Garvey, you know, very much, of course, first through Brother Malcolm, but also through Garvey. Thinking about Chicago, Malcolm X College, the first institution in the planet named after Brother Malcolm, was here, or was up in Chicago. If you go up there today, you see all the red, black, and green flags. His car is up there. And that school was founded through the protests of black, young black people on the west side of Chicago, the Panthers as well, who demanded that Crane College, then a Chicago community college, be renamed Malcolm X College, and to advance a black-centered agenda.
Just a couple of minutes before we need to take a break, I want to ask who is fighting the battle for Africa today, and how is it being fought?
Oh my, that's a huge, my, where to start with that one? It's being fought on multiple fronts, right? In particular, on the continent. And I think this is one of the important developments in the black world, that during the early 20th century, people in the diaspora, so folks like Garvey, folks like W.E.B. Du Bois, saw themselves as being more enlightened, more civilized, to actually use the term that was often used during the early 20th century. Although I'm not sure if Du Bois used the term civilized, certainly Garvey did. And then by the mid-20th century and as we move forward, there's a shift where folks in the diaspora recognize that it's going to be the continent that will lead the struggle for African liberation. But for that question in terms of today, I think there's some very exciting movements, especially across the Sahel. Ibrahim Traoré in Burkina Faso, you know, just kick the French out, you know, forming this association of Sahel states. What is it? Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger.
Do you see China and Russia entering the chat?
Oh, very much so. I mean, oh my goodness. Yes. Russia, China, especially China, incredibly visible in the continent in terms of its investments. Certainly, of course, it's complicated. You know, some folks have referred to China as the new imperialist, but what is clear, if you go to the continent, you'll see it. The Chinese are heavily, deeply invested in the continent in ways that really frightens and scares the U.S.
All right, we're going to take another break, after which we will have more with Eric McDuffie, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, author of The Second Battle for Africa. We first aired this interview back in May, so no calls, but you can always let us know what you think. Our voicemail line, 217-300-2121. 217-300-2121. More to come after a break. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. My guest for the hour today is historian Eric S. McDuffie. His book is The Second Battle for Africa, Garveyism, the U.S. Heartland, and Global Black Freedom. McDuffie is a sixth-generation Midwesterner and an associate professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He has affiliations with a long list of campus units, including African American Studies, History, the Center for Global Studies, the Program in Jewish Culture and Society, the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies, the Lehman Center for Brazilian Studies, and the Center for African Studies, where McDuffie will be director starting this fall. And all that is just the kind of thing the Trump administration thinks is a misplaced emphasis in American higher education, and that's putting it politely. So I'm hoping to talk with McDuffie about that in the last part of our conversation today. So, how it started, how's it going?
It's going, yeah.
I mean, what's it been like, your entire field of academic work and
yes.
your, you know, the entire like area beyond yes. your individual fields is under intense scrutiny from President Trump and people in his orbit. What has that been like?
In fact, I would say more than just scrutiny, I would say attack.
Sure.
Right? It has been, I'll speak for myself, but I know I'm not alone, and in a very extremely difficult and stressful year. I would say really the last 2 years, in no small part to the Israeli, just to Gaza, right? And the ongoing genocide there, and just how that's playing out, not only globally, but here on campus. The attacks by the Trump administration against African-American studies, ethnic studies, and higher education. And, you know, I think it's important that we understand how all of these issues, you know, I just said Gaza, the attacks against African-American studies, ethnic studies, higher ed. I think we need to understand how all of these issues are inextricably linked. And how, you know, attacks against LGBT, queer trans folks, attacks against immigrant communities, attacks against free speech, academic freedom. And then, of course, President Trump's, those executive orders, restoring sanity and truth to American history, the Dear Colleague letter that schools received across the country, this a kind of just attack against DEI and everything. So it has been a difficult, you know, 2 years. Yeah.
What... You know, I'm interested to imagine there's an Archie Bunker type person. Maybe that, boy, that's condescending to say it that way. There are people out there who maybe don't see the value. Like, why don't we just have history? Why do we have to have African-American history?
Mm-hmm.
Can you make that case
absolutely, for people? Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, tying it back to the book and tying it back to Garvey, you know, one of the places where Garvey was so brilliant is that he understood like no one else, or maybe was able to articulate and to build a movement like no one else. He understood the centrality of race, to the shaping and making of the modern world, to shaping every aspect of the world in which we live. It's undeniable that white supremacy, the exploitation, violence against African people, violence against indigenous people, was critical to the making of the modern world, critical to the wealth that this country and Western Europe enjoys. If you look at the Federal Constitution of 1787, it included, right, most famously or infamously, right, the Three-Fifths Clause, right? The Constitution would not have been passed had it not been for a Three-Fifths Clause, because the South was afraid of being outnumbered in the House due to their due to the North's larger population. So what do they do? That three-fifths clause, that the counting African people as three-fifths of people, which helped to give the South a lock on power in the federal government. I mean, these questions. I mean, this is it's almost ludicrous that we're even having these conversations. But also, again, and this is what I do in class. You know, my classes are not about oppression and, oh, you know, woe is us. The brilliance and creativity of African descended people. So going back to your first caller, right, and the person I think was talking about jazz, right, the way in which Black musics have been, again, just how they shape popular life and music and beyond, the brilliance and genius of Black people. So, again, to me, it's almost impossible to have a conversation. I mean, it's almost, to me, nonsensical that we're having this conversation. But at the very same time, I do understand why it's happening, right? Mm. It's part of an ideological backlash to the civil rights, Black power movement, to the women's movement, and globally and beyond shifts in global capitalism. And we've witnessed in this country over the last 30, 40 years, again, a backlash to, again, the civil rights, Black power movement, which at its core attempted to fundamentally transform this country to make it a more democratic place. And then, of course, in the last 5 years, we've been dealing with the backlash to Black Lives Matter, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor. And lastly, and again, I think it's so important, and this is what Garvey, this is what Brother Malcolm, Louise Little, what they prompt us to understand. We always need to understand the local and national in a global context. So it's important for us to understand that it's not just like that Trump is part of a much larger global right-wing authoritarian fascist movement in which the far right the right has mainstreamed racism, mainstream xenophobia, mainstreamed transphobia. So, yes.
Are you, you know, we've been through quite a couple of decades. You're going back many decades when you're talking about this backlash.
Yeah.
There are people who just look at the last 5 years, mm-hmm. right? We went from a national conversation on race and you know, BLM placards going up in windows. I'm sure the neighborhoods that you run mm-hmm. through, we talked on this program
yes,
a few years ago about
yes,
what it's like running while Black after
yep.
the Ahmaud Arbery was murdered
yep.
in Georgia. What is that? I'm not going to ask if you're surprised. What has it been like the last 5 years seeing that, you know, that seeming pendulum swing that way
yep.
and right back?
Great question. I mean, it feels like the events of 2020 was like a lifetime ago, right? And it was only 5 years ago,
yeah.
right? As you
five
say,
5 years
right?
and 1 week
exactly.
is when we talked on this program.
Exactly,
yeah.
right? And the kind of racial reckoning that this country said that was occurring, you know, the largest movements, the largest social protests movements in global history, what, 35 million people took to the streets in the summer of 2020 to call for racial justice, the end of state violence against Black people. And then now here we are, right? Certainly, of course, yes, Trump is in part a response to that. But again, it's been a long haul in terms of the backlash. But also, again, how we can never overlook the structural components of all this, that there's no question, costs of living, economic disparities. But what Trump has been able to do so effectively, and this has been a fascist tool that's worked very effectively for them, is how they take those grievances, especially among white working class people who are again, seeing the world through highly racialized and gendered terms. How Trump and his allies, how they build on that, and then things like the war or the attacks against DEI and all this other stuff and woke. It's a way to, I think, to kind of placate the anxieties that many people, white folks, as well as plenty of Black folks and folks of color, are feeling, right? But again, steering it not in a constructive, at least I would argue, not in a constructive way, but again, in a racist, xenophobic, anti-immigrant way.
You know, I don't know that you want to go here, but
we're
you know,
talking politics
you look at
here, Brian. This is great.
All right. Well, so.
2016, 2020,
yeah,
and 2024, 8%, 13%, 20%, which is President Trump's share of
yeah.
black voters.
Sure, yes.
I mean, you know, some people have flippantly suggested there's a new class solidarity happening or realignment happening in this country, though it's not the way people who usually use that mm-hmm. language would mm-hmm. like to see.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that?
Oh, that's a great question. Certainly plenty of people have written about this. I mean, we are seeing political realignments happening in this country. We are seeing, in some ways, this is generational as well as class, but it's also gendered. Hmm. So the folk, in terms of African Americans who are supporting Trump, disproportionately men, often younger men who embrace that kind of toxic masculinity that Trump promotes. But I think it speaks to a larger crisis, not only in Black America, but in this country and globally. And again, getting back to my book, I think, you know, this is why Garveyism so deeply resonated with Black people. How do we make a way out of nowhere? How did we get here? How do we get out? And for now, given the suppression, destruction of the Black left, of a kind of a viable social democratic or progressive and beyond left in this country and globally, there are apparently, you know, no other alternatives except for the Democrats or more right-wing forces. And some people are joining those right-wing forces. But as we know, history has shown that even folks who, you know, certain populations who support fascism, they can find themselves on the chopping block, quite literally.
Where do you find hope
today? Oh, that's a great question. Where do I find hope? I find hope both, well, first of all, in history, right? And yes, we are living through unprecedented times, at least in terms of living memory. But I think back to the Civil War, Reconstruction, actually to the 1850s and the years before the Civil War, where many of the conversations that we're having right now in terms of Black America and even right here in the studio, you know, where do Black folks go from here? Do we go back to Africa? Do we just create separatist institutions? Do we try to fight from within? And then soon thereafter, there was the Civil War, Reconstruction, a very brief moment in this country's history where this country was trying to build a multiracial democracy. Of course, it was overthrown through violence, through terrorism. But I still, again, the hope of African descended people, even in the most violent, oppressive situations. That's what gives me hope, as well as young people, as young Black people, brown people, queer folk, their allies. You know, again, despite all the violence and insanity that is happening, you have people, you have movements. I'm not just talking in abstract terms. We need to look no further than our own campus, right? The work around Palestine, the work around protecting immigrants, the efforts to protect the ethnic studies and gender and women's studies and cultural houses. So yes. I mean, these are tough times. These are tough times, but I have not given up hope.
All right. Eric McDuffie is associate professor at the University of Illinois. He's a historian. His book is The Second Battle for Africa, Garveyism, the U.S. Heartland, and Global Black Freedom. Professor McDuffie, thank you for being with us today on the 21st Show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's all the time we have for our program today. Coming up tomorrow on the 21st Show, we'll have an update on the investigation into the death of Jelani Day, the 25-year-old Illinois State University grad student whose case remains unsolved 4 years after he disappeared from campus and was later found dead in the Illinois River. I want to to mention our texting group, which you can join by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. It's a great way to keep in touch with us. We often send out questions and information about the segments we're working on. We love incorporating your comments and questions in our conversations on the program. Again, you can join the texting group, 217-803-0730, and just send the word TALK, T-A-L-K, to that number. That number and every other way to contact us, our email address, our voicemail line, it's all on our website, 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. We've got all of our past programs there, and you can find links to subscribe to our podcast, or just look us up on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you listen. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Layla Nazarova is an associate producer, and our digital producer is Coulson Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.